Okay, good morning. Hopefully you can hear me. Let's see. So the thought for this week is to continue with the relationship between integration and derivatives. That'll tell us things both about derivatives, statements that don't even involve integrals in the statement, but we'll be able to prove them using integrals, and also, of course, more useful facts about integrals. Okay, so let's see. Let me just start with a little bit of a summary of what we know about the spaces that we've been working with, and then indicate to what extent we can get the fundamental thermal calculus to work on these spaces, and also what that tells us about them. So let's see. So recall. Okay, so I have a little diagram. If I have an interval, then I can look at the Riemann integrable functions on that interval. Okay, and since they're integrable, we can integrate them, and so that'll give us a map. I called it J before. So that's the integral map. And we proved last time, this was theorem 12.6, that that leaves us with a continuous function. So we land in the continuous functions on AB. And I guess the other thing we knew was that continuous functions are Riemann integrable. So we also know over here that the continuous functions live inside of here. Okay, so those are some facts that we knew about Riemann integrable functions. But I want to make my diagram more complicated and add a few more things to it. And so one thing is the functions that are continuously differentiable. So those we know by almost by definition that if we take the derivative, then we get something that is continuous. That's the definition. But in between, we have some functions that are differentiable, but possibly not continuously. Okay. And they land somewhere. They land in these spaces of derivatives. Let me call it d0 again, as I have before. And just by definition, those are the things you get if you differentiate any function that has a derivative. Okay, so that's what the definition. So this is onto by definition. All right, and the types of things we're going to get out of integration is that some of these maps are bijections or close. And let's see how close they can be. So first of all, let me modify these just ever so slightly. I'm going to require these functions to be zero at A. So then we know that these maps are inclusions. So this is going to be the set of all f in C1 AB such that f of A is equal to zero. And the reason I want to do that is because we know that when we take this integral, so let me recall JF of X, the definition was just the integral from A to X of f of y dy. That was our definition. And recall that that means that JF at A is automatically zero because we're just integrating up to zero. So that's. Just comes from the definition. So we know that we're going to land there. And also we know that if we fix the value to be zero, then there's only one, then this map is an inclusion. And that was by theorem 8.35, which said that there was only one, if two functions agreed on their derivatives, then they differed by a constant. Okay, so if we set it to one value, then we're set. So this is a big diagram. I kind of like my big diagram, and it allows me to remember what's going on. The other thing that we learned was that every differentiable function was continuous. Okay, so that's pretty much everything that we know now, and I want to add some more facts using the integrals. Okay, so so again, for me, I find that diagram to be very good at reminding me facts we already know. So that's why I have drawn it for you. All right, but let's add a few more facts. And so the main one is going to come from this theorem. There were two more theorems about the fundamental theorem. One of them is 12.4, and the other is going to be 12.1. They're basically the fundamental theorem in two different directions. So this one says that if we have a Riemann integrable function, okay, and it's continuous at C, okay, some point inside of there, then we have if we first take the integral and then differentiate, so let me write that as D for differentiate and then J for the integral, and then I'm going to apply that to my function F and evaluate that at C, then I just get my function back. So it's the fact that I differentiate and then I go back. Okay. Right. So let me just prove that. And and then get a couple of useful corollaries that I can use to modify my my diagram over here. All right. So since my function is continuous at C, I can just write down what that tells me. Okay. So since F is continuous at C, what does that mean? It says that for every epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta, so that whenever I have H smaller than delta, then we have that the value of F at C plus H differs by at most epsilon from the value of F. And let me write it this way. So this, it lives somewhere between F at C minus epsilon and F at C plus epsilon. Okay, so that's what it means to be continuous at C, right? Any questions about that? All right, so if it's continuous at C, what else does that tell us? Well, since every value here is inside of this regime, if I take the largest value that I see here and the smallest value, which are the ones that come up in the integral, they're also inside of here. So let me just write that down. So the sup over the size of H less than equal to delta of F of C plus H is in the same interval, and similarly the inf. Because every value is, so of course the biggest and smallest values are. Okay, but those are important because those are what come up in the integral. In particular, that tells us that if I look at the integral from C to C plus H of this function F, okay, so actually, can anyone tell me what are the biggest and smallest values that this integral can have? So if I draw a little picture over here, I have my value C here, and I'm integrating it over to C plus H, and I know that the values up here are somewhere between C plus or minus epsilon, F of C plus or minus epsilon, okay, so so what can I say about the integral from C to C plus H? make sense. So if I use just one partition that just has one interval in it, exactly, it's going to be h times whatever this height is, and that height's going to be this f of c plus or minus epsilon. Okay. So let me write that up. So this is going to be less than or equal to, and bigger than or equal to. So it's going to be within the regime, which is, so I can approximate it from above, okay, with an h on this, sorry, with a u, or from below with an l. So it's bigger than or equal to the l, and less than or equal to the u, okay? And where I take the same f, and just use the partition that goes from c to c plus h, so just with a single box, okay? So that's a, not a great approximation, but it's an approximation, right? So I can just use the single box partition. All right, and this is equal to just the width times the sup or the inf. So this is equal to the h times the sup, and this is equal to h times the inf. Okay, so we get this integral from c to c plus h of f of y dy is between h times f of c minus epsilon and f of c plus epsilon. Okay, because I just took the value of that height and multiplied it by h. Okay, any questions about that? So that's giving me this this area, because now I'm just going to use that and write down the formula. Okay, so let me just do that and see if that all makes sense. So I'm supposed to be computing the derivative of the integral. So let me just write out what that is. So computing now. So that was my side computation, but now I'm going to do the. And I'm going to use that to get the actual computation. So I'm going to compute d j f at c. So what does that mean? So that's the limit, because it's d as h goes to zero, right? Of j of f, jf evaluated at c plus h minus jf evaluated at c divided by h. That's just the definition of a derivative. Okay. And now I can plug in the definition of j. So this is the limit as h goes to zero, just leaving that alone. And now I'm going to plug in j. So j is the integral from a to a c plus h of f of y dy. And of course, j f at c is the integral from a to c, the same thing, f of y dy. And I'm going to leave the h alone. Okay, so all I did now was I plugged in the two definitions, the definition of d, that was my derivative, and the definition of j, that's my integral. Any questions about that? So far, all I've done is understand my definitions. Okay, but now I can use properties of integrals. So the integral of the difference of those integrals is the integral over the difference. So this is the limit h goes to zero of one over h. And then I have the integral from c to c plus h. Well, that's good, because that's getting closer to what I have, to what I have up here is the integral from c to c plus h, right? So that's something I know about of again, everybody why. Okay, but now I'm pretty much done because I'm dividing here by h, and I have this h. I'm going to divide by h, so I get that this this limit here is between f of c minus epsilon and f of c plus epsilon. Coming from the above computation. Okay, so Okay, any questions about that proof?
Yeah, I do have a question. Like,
okay, yep.
Like you show that like the DJ F of C is an element of that set, but how did you get the next line that it is equal to F of C?
That it's equal to F of C. Yes. Okay. So let me run through the quantifiers here. So what I showed was that if I go all the way back up here, for every epsilon greater than zero, I'm going to get that this limit is an element of this set. Okay. And since epsilon is I can take epsilon arbitrarily small, then I have that it lives between this and 0.01. Plus and 0.01 minus. So that's where I get it. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that does. Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I do get some corollaries from this, which are helpful corollaries. So let me just mention a couple of those. So corollary of 12.4. So one was something we asserted way, way back at the beginning, and we can finally prove it. The statement that has nothing to do with integrals a priori, but we can use this integral fact to prove it. And so that is if I look at a continuous function on AB, that's automatically a derivative. Okay, so this was something we asserted early on, but we didn't have a way to prove. So let's prove that. So that says that, actually, maybe before I prove it, let me just note what that means. For example, now I'll just prove it, and I'll do some examples. Okay, so it follows directly because what we've written here is that I've written as a derivative this function f. So I found something that it's a derivative of, but the key is that it's a derivative of something. Okay, so proof. If I have f continuous, then f is equal to f prime, where f of x is equal to capital F of x is equal to j little f of x, which is just equal to the integral from a to x of little f of y dy, which is what we just finished proving. So in other words, we found a function for which it is a derivative, and that's the definition of being in D0. Hence, f is a derivative. And in D0. Okay, so we found before we found restrictions on derivatives, now we found a bunch of functions that we can actually assert are in fact derivatives. Okay, and let me mention one other corollary that follows from this. A corollary. So maybe I'll add that to my diagram. So I can diagram. So this says that I have every continuous function here is a derivative. So this is from 12.4. Okay. Another thing I get is that this map over here is a bijection. Okay. So we already have that it's injective, but it's also surjective. Okay. So this is a bijection between these two sets. Corollary again of 12.4. The map from the functions which are continuously differentiable and zero at A to this capital B. The derivative is a bijection. Okay. crowded there. Okay, so that's a fact. So we from 8.35, if we have that D of F is equal to D of G, then F is equal to G plus a constant. But if F of A equals G of A equals zero, but that's also equal to G of A plus C, then of course we have that C equals zero, so F equals G. And D is injective. Okay, so to show that it's bijective, we just have to show that it's onto, okay? All right, so, but by 12.4, D is onto. Since J F has a is since DJF is equal to F, and that's all I really have to write. Okay, all right, so that's two helpful facts. So we got that this was an inclusion, and now we've learned more about it. We learned that that map, the derivative here, is actually a bijection. All right, so that's a couple of nice facts that follow from our fundamental theorem of calculus. Let me do a few examples of using this. So one of them is that we can just use integrals to define functions. And that's actually quite handy and something people do. Finding integrals in terms of other functions is often very hard, as you know from calculus, from Math 21. But if you just define it to be the integral, that can be helpful also. And let me just do two examples of that. So using integrals that to define functions, and these come from the text. All right, so one of them is the natural log. Natural log of x, you can just define it to be the integral from 1 to x of dx over x. And that's a handy definition. Let me use it to show a property just because it's helpful. So so this is, of course, the well-known property of logs, but it follows from this definition. And so the property is that the log of the product is the sum of the logs. Okay, and let's just see how you would prove that from this definition. Okay, so a proof. All right, so let's try the sum of the logs and then get that to be the product, because that's the easier way to do it. So I have the log of x plus the log of y. All right, and if I use this definition, that's the same as the integral from 1 to x of f of t dt plus the integral from 1 to y of f of t dt. Okay, and I'd like to just combine those into a single integral, because that's what this right-hand side, left-hand side is a single integral, right, from 1 to something. But the problem here, of course, is that this one starts at 1 and ends at x, right? So I go from 1 to x, and the other one goes from 1 to y. So they overlap. And what I would like is for them not to overlap, okay? And so there's a trick that allows me to make them not overlap, and that's so that I can change variables so that this one starts at x and goes to something else, okay? So then I can combine. So let me do that. So this is equal to, I'm going to leave the first one alone, and I'm going to change variables in the second one. Okay, so I'm going to take s is equal to, I want it to start at x. That's my goal, right? And so I'm going to take t is equal to, so I'm going to start here at, so s is equal to x times, actually, sorry, I'm writing it backwards. I want x equal s times x. T equal x times s. Sorry, as written. Okay, so that's what I like. Okay, so I'm sorry, I keep writing it backward. I do apologize. Let me fix it. What I want is when t is 1, s is x. So when t is 1, s is x. So that's the right way to do it. Okay, so then I can do the substitution. And so then I get t is equal to 1 over x times s. So dt is equal to 1 over x times ds. And then I can just do my substitution. All right, so is it clear what this f is in all my formulas? Right. Yeah, so all of these f's are just 1 over t, right? Because I'm supposed to be using my definition here. So. So let me put them in. So 1 over t, right? And these are just copied from my definition right here. So that's supposed to be just copied from the definition. Okay, sorry about all that mess. But anyway, now it's all correct. And now I can do my substitutions. So let me do that. So this is from x equals 1. So over here, when x equals 1, then I have s is equal to x. And when x is equal to, I'm sorry, when t is equal to 1, s is equal to x. And when t is equal to y, s is equal to xy. Okay, so now I can plug all those things in, and I have this gives me my lower bound. This one gives me my upper bound. Okay, and this replaces the dt, and this is going to replace the t. So then I can just do all that and. I get the substitution that tells me that s runs from x to xy. And I have dt is 1 over x ds. And t is equal to 1 over s over x. And I'm taking 1 over that. So I have x over s. OK. And so then this is equal to. Natural log of x, and then this one is equal to all right, so then I can combine these and I get the integral from 1 up to xy of 1 over t dt, which is equal to what I wanted. Okay, sorry, that was more painful than needed to be. Any questions about that? Okay, let me do a, this is example 12.14 in the text. I want to look at that. Okay, and then a couple others. So one that's another that's popular, I'll just mention it. So let's see, 12.15. The error function is a popular one. So this is also, you just define it using integrals. So this is get the numbers right, but it's a 2 over root pi. There's a normalization that makes it particularly convenient. And it's the integral of e to the minus t squared dt. And again, this is something where you can't write a formula for it, okay? But you can just use that integral as the definition. And so that's such an easy. Let me do one more example here. I want to show that there's a single function. Let me say capital F of X with some property. And so now I can get to that certain property. So for example, where I can say that the third derivative of X of F is equal to this e to the minus X squared. Okay, so it has the, so it looks a bit like something whose derivative is something complicated. And F of zero is equal to F prime of zero is equal to F of one is equal to zero. Okay. So is it clear how I would do something like that? So I'm trying to find something that where I have control on a derivative, right? So how would I build a function capital F that has a given third derivative? So first of all, we know that e to the minus x is continuous. I'm sorry, e to the minus x squared is continuous. A derivative right, so I know there's some function there, right? That's what I just finished proving, was that all continuous functions are in fact derivatives. Okay, so it's a derivative of something, all right, and so I can just start integrating. And if I take the j of e to the minus x squared, so that's is the integral from 0 to a to x of f of t dt, but my f is now just e to the minus t squared. Okay. And let me call this little g. G prime is equal to e to the minus t squared, right? I can just start integrating, and I'll get this back. Okay, so then I can keep going. So how would I get something whose third derivative is what I want? I can just repeat, right? H of X is equal to J of G of X. Okay, and K of X is equal to J of H of X. So I can just go three times. So we get that k triple derivative of x is equal to e to the minus x squared, as we want. We can just keep going back. Okay. But now we can use the fact that that the derivatives are almost unique, but not quite, right? So what are all the g, how do I get other functions whose derivative is e to the minus t squared?
You're going to have to use the fact about f of 0 equaling f prime of 0 equaling f of 1.
That's right. That's right. We're going to have to make use of that fact. And here's one way to do it. There are various ways to do it. One way to do it is to say that the only other function with the same derivative, which we worked out back in section 8.35, said that if I have two functions with the same derivative, I guess I used it down here, then they differ by a constant, right? So any two functions that have the same derivative differ by a constant. I have one function over here that has the derivative e to the minus t squared. So if I had another function, then it would have to be g plus a constant. So those are the only possibilities. So, g plus c has this, have this derivative. Okay, so then I can keep going. So only, all right, but now when I integrate this, I can get the h plus, let me add the x's in, so h of x plus, and when I integrate the c, I'm going to get cx plus d have this second derivative. Right, and so then I can keep going. So in the end, I end up with only k of x plus 1/2 c x squared plus d x plus e. I'll call it e. So B have this as circular. Okay, so we can restrict how many we get just by using that fact over and over. And we can just repeat. And then, as you say, we can now make use of the requirements on our function. So now use the initial conditions. Which are that f of 0. And so let's see, this is going to be a k of 0 plus 1/2 c times 0 plus d times 0 plus b is supposed to be equal to 0, right? And f prime at 0 is going to be k prime at 0 plus 2c times 0 plus d plus 0 is equal to 0. And then f at 1 is equal to k of 1 plus, oops, extra 2 there. It doesn't matter because there's a 0. Okay. plus 1/2 c times 1 plus d times 1 plus b is equal to 0, right? And so then I can just solve for my a, b, and c. So we get, let's see. So from this first one, I get b. And from the second one, I get D. And so all I need is C, and I can now compute that. Is it F triple prime? Right, yes, right. So what I want is that the F triple prime should be equal to e to the minus x squared. Okay. Right. So maybe I should write that here. Sorry. So this is equal to my. I'm going to cover it. equal to my f of x as third derivative. So this is then equal to f, as you say, triple prime third derivative of x. Okay. So that's it. Are there any questions about where I am now? So let me just finish. So the last thing is C, and then see if there are questions. So I can use this last equation here. So this says that C is equal to minus K of 1 minus 1 half, not a half, no half there. So, but 2 times, so this is 1 half C is equal to minus K of 1, and then minus D. And then minus B, but we just computed D and B. So this is equal to minus K of 1 minus a negative, so plus K prime of 0 minus a negative, so plus K of 0. Right, so I solved for B, D, and C. And and there is only one choice for X, for F. Okay, so did that make sense? So it's a little bit complicated in that I didn't find really a formula for F. What I found was a way to build it by taking integrals and then by substituting in some values. But I showed that there was only one such f, and this is, and that's what I was asked to do. So there was only one, and I did that. Okay, any questions about that example? Okay, so there's maybe two more things I wanted to do today. So one of them is, to try to figure out just how generally, I go back to my picture here, just how generally I can make this work. Okay, and let me just note one example that we haven't really covered yet. So what about functions that are not continuously differentiable? So what about, so consider, one of the functions that we started with, so something like x squared cosine of 1 over x and 0, so this is where x is non-zero, and this is where x is 0. So this is a function that we've looked at quite a bit, so f of x is equal to this. And remember what this one looks like. It has a derivative, but its derivative is not continuous. So this is... f is differentiable, now let me just put 0 to 1, okay. Places. Well, minus 1 is fine, but not continuously. Okay, so if we go back up here, we know that there are some functions here that are not continuously differentiable, and this is an example of that. This f that lives here. And so what I'd like to do is see what happens if I differentiate that, and then I try to integrate it back. Okay, so that's going to be the plan. Derivative df. We worked out before. So this is equal to cosine of two x times the cosine of one over x minus the sine of one over x and zero. And the hard part was the zero, but the rest we could use our rules from Math 21, but the zero part we had to do some extra work. But we worked this out earlier, okay, and this was the derivative that we got. And this is not continuous. Okay. So we would like to answer the question is, the integral from 0 to x of this function here, let me just write it as df because it's shorter than writing that whole big mess, which is what it is, but I could write that whole thing and that would be what that means, all right? Equal to what you would expect, which is back to our function f. And f of 0 is at 0, so of course that's just f of x. So that would be the question, all right? And so far we haven't been able to prove it because we proved that that works fine as long as we're over here with continuously differentiable functions, but we want to try to do it in this more general case. Okay, and that's the last of the proof, and then we'll be done with the fundamental theorem statements. So this follows from so the answer is yes. And it follows from the following theorem, 12.1. It says that as long as we have a derivative which is itself integrable, then we're in good shape. Okay, and it's a little bit complicated because of the fact that our notion of Riemann integrable is a little bit complicated. So let me write it out. So if we have a function f, and the properties that we need are that it should be differentiable on AB, and this is fairly usual, and it should also be continuous at the endpoints. So that's a small extra additional consideration that we've had before. So that's just a condition at the endpoints, because everywhere in the middle, of course, it's already continuous. But the main thing that we have to add is that its derivative, which we know exists now, is Riemann integrable. Okay, that's usually true. Okay, but we have to argue that it's, but we need it, okay? And it's not always true. And notice in this case, is this function Riemann integrable? So we proved a theorem last time that enables us to. Yes, it is. And why is that? So as long as we avoid zero, then we get a continuous function, and so that's Riemann integrable. But we showed that as long as it's Riemann integrable for every neighborhood away from zero, that we can take the limit and it's still Riemann integrable as long as it's bounded. Okay. So that's something I proved last time. Okay, so it fits into this theorem. All right, so this theorem will be what we need. So let me just prove the theorem and then we'll be done. So proof. All right. First of all, since our function has a derivative that's Riemann integrable, we can choose a partition that works well. Okay. So for all epsilon, there exists a partition of AB so that if I take the left integral of this derivative, which I can do because I assume, oops, little f, this is the letter I used, same letter. So a little f prime, which I can do because this function is integrable, okay? Then this is less than or equal to what I get by taking the approximation using that p and then adding some epsilon. Okay, so I might be off by epsilon, but I can get within epsilon as the right answer. Okay, and of course, same thing for the other side. The upper bound for f prime, I want to also be related to the upper bound associated to this partition, off by at most epsilon. Okay, and then we compute. All right, let's see. So it says that, apologize. I never wrote a conclusion, right? I just had hypotheses. I never had conclusions, sorry. Then, if I take the integral of the derivative, then I get the function back. So JD of F is equal to F at B is equal to F at B minus F at A. So that's the okay, so I have to compute that. So let me compute those two things. So JD of F of X is equal to. All right, so that's just the integral from A to X of F of df, so f prime of t dt, right? That's what it means to take the derivative and then take the integral. So that's what I have. And so then this is equal to, it's equal to the lower bound and the also the upper bound. Okay, so we'll do both of those. So this is equal to L f prime, right? And then now I can just use what I have above. So this is less than or equal to, L of F prime using my partition P plus this epsilon. Okay, and this is less than or equal to, actually, maybe I'll just write it as equal. So if I just write out what that L is, that's the sum, right, over all the parts. I equal to N, it's a finite sum. And then I have the length of each interval. And then I have the soup, the inf of the value of T in my interval I, the ith interval of the partition P, and then I have F prime of T, and then plus my F. Okay, that's just the definition of the integral. All right, and almost done here. So then this is, less than or equal to. Okay, so now I can use the mean value theorem to get a bound on the derivative. So this is less than or equal to the sum of Li, and now I can take f evaluated at the largest value there, so x sub I minus f evaluated at the smallest one, x sub I minus 1, divided by the difference. That's what the mean value theorem tells me. And that's just equal to the L. So then this is equal to telescopes the F at X minus F at A. What's up? And then we're done. So similarly, u of f prime is bigger than or equal to f of x minus f of a minus epsilon, and we're done. Sorry, we've got time to do that. Anyway, I will stop here and stick around in case there are questions.